Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum, and it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit.
Hi, this is Joan Renner from Deranged LA Crimes in Los Angeles, California, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
I want to get out of the deal. I said you could still sell a house and all of that. I said, but, you know, you got to give me the money back. Long story short, he says, no, I'm not giving the money back. No way. I'm not doing it. And I said to him, you really want to go this road? I said, because...
So when they take the silver dollar, they got to go around different banks and cash.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome back into the studio here in the Ice House, classic old building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here in the Studio 4 with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, folks, tonight we have a special show as kind of part of our New York month. We've got Andrew DiDonato on one evening. We've got Ed Scarpo, another show. And tonight we have Andrea Giovino calling in from Pennsylvania, I believe. Hello, Andrea. It's great to have you on the show tonight.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. You say it's snowing there in Pennsylvania?
Yep, we're having snow right now in Pennsylvania.
Well, dang, that's it's colder than heck here in Kansas City, so I feel your pain. At least we don't have the snow. I'm always looking around for guests that have books or people with firsthand knowledge of the lifestyle of organized crime in the United States, and it's pretty easy to find former FBI agents and coppers who have direct experiences, and it's a little harder to find people who were in the life that have a direct experience that want to talk. And we've had several on here. We've had a couple guys from Chicago, particularly Frank Culotta and Frank Calabrese Jr.
Red Womet.
And Red Womet. So we've had three of them from Chicago, but we've not had anybody from back east before and any connected with the New York families. And so you're kind of our first here. We've got some secondhand knowledge from Ed Scarpo, and we talked to Andrew DiDonato. So this month we'll have two of our first, what we call forays into the New York mob with people with firsthand experience. I'm really happy to have you here tonight. Can you tell the people here a little bit about your growing up to kind of give a history of how you became involved in this lifestyle?
I became involved in this lifestyle. My mom, back in the early 60s, was running crack dens in the basement of our home for Crazy Joe Gallo. And what happened back then, you know, I'm one of 10, so my dad was a tractor trailer driver, but, you know, there was a lot of poverty back in the day. So the street guys were the guys that were making money. They used to pay my mom, play cards in the basement. And, you know, we were very young. We would, you know, go upstairs, serve them food, and she'd get paid for that. So I was very comfortable growing up with the guys in the neighborhood And, you know, eventually as I became a teenager, that's what I was attracted to because that's what I was comfortable with. They didn't believe in education because they felt that education, you go and you learn bad things in college or in, you know, high school. You learn how to drink, do drugs, have sex. So my dad was more about get married, find a guy, cater to your husband. And basically, that was a big farce because every woman today, I feel, should have an education. But that's why I got involved with the people I got involved with, because of low self-esteem and not being able to have it, an education, and being comfortable with people that's all I knew was that type of personality. I started, like, in the neighborhood that I grew up in Brooklyn, Bensonhurst, everybody knew the street guys. And I think that I dated a lot of street guys, but Frank Lino, at 22 years old, he was a captain. And I was with him for quite a few years. And I think I learned a lot from him about the street life. And then after that, it was more Mark Ryder, which I was very comfortable with. John Gotti, Mark Ryder, you know, I knew all those, you know, very high profile organized crime people. That's why I was asked to do the show, coming out in June called Gotti and Son. And I myself is the only woman on it, opposed to Angel Gotti, which is John Gotti Sr.'s daughter, because of the accuracy of Bruce Cutler knowing me, which was John Gotti's attorney, that I ran with these people, and they were very comfortable speaking in front of me because they knew I knew the lifestyle and they knew they could trust me of not saying stuff that I had overheard. But lo and behold, when I do speaking engagements or I do TV, and there will be a film, I'm working on a film right now of my life story, I do believe that it's a very, very hard life. It's a tough life. You either, you know, get killed or go to prison for a long time. It's all not worth it. I try to, when I do speaking engagements, teach women to not go after the bad guy or the guy in the fast lane that has the quick cash, that education is very important, and that without education, you know, you're going to make poor choices in your life the way I did, because of low self-esteem.
Andrea, you wrote a book, Divorced from the Mob.
Correct.
That's that's available at Amazon. And is that available on your website also?
I think it's available right now on Amazon. Yeah. I don't know if it's still on my website.
No, probably a Kindle book out there. Yeah. Sometimes authors will have a book on their website that if somebody, you know, we'll put a note in there and say, send me an autographed copy, that, like I do that for my book.
No, I don't have that.
Okay.
But I think that, I'll go through like how the guys in the neighborhood, I'll tell you one particular story that's a pretty good story. The guys in the neighborhood going back in that time frame, that era, take care of their own. Italians take care of their own. I had a problem. I had been divorced from a legal businessman that I was married to. I was in the midst of buying a home. Back in the day, they didn't have the law where you had to show where your money came from. So long story short, I put $60,000 on a house in Queens Village. The house was $260,000, so I put $60,000 under the table with the guy. He was an Irish guy that owned a couple of bars in Manhattan or along Second Avenue. So I gave him $60,000 cash money, but then I decided a couple months later I didn't want to stay in Queens. I wanted to move back to Brooklyn. So I had said to him, I want to get out of the deal. I said, you could still sell a house and all that. I said, but, you know, you got to give me the money back. Long story short, he says, no, I'm not giving the money back. No way. I'm not doing it. And I said to him, you really want to go this road? I said, because, I mean, this is not something that I'm going to sit back and take. You really, you know, like I kept trying to really work with this guy to give me the money back. He didn't want to give me the money back. Long story short, I go to the club in Brooklyn where all the street guys are that know me. And Danny Marino was there, which became the boss after Sammy Gravano
flipped. He took over. Danny took over. He was a captain back then. He was very, very, very very recognized and also very well respected in the street. And he knew me very well. I told him the story, and I'll never forget. It was a Thursday. He said to me, "You're going to be home." I was living in Queens at the time. "You'll be home tomorrow morning?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to be home." And he said, "Okay, I'll have somebody contact you." I said, "Okay." And then, lo and behold, they went to the guy's bar. The old man had his son working for him. The son was working. There were four guys that pulled up, and they said who they, you know, they let them know that, you know, we were street people and that you're not going to beat her. They took the son in the car to the father's house, and they gave him no other choice but to give the money back. And I'm not going to say what was done, what wasn't done, but the next morning, 10 o'clock, somebody was at my door with the whole $60,000. And I said, "Well, why didn't you take something, $5,000, whatever?" And they said, no, we're not taking anything because nobody's going to come into our neighborhood and try to shake down somebody that we know that is, you know, a good person, that, you know, you just don't beat a woman."
Interesting.
So they did take care of their own if they knew.
Really?
Like, people get scared of organized crime, and they think, like, oh, what these people are going to do. They never go out and hurt innocent people. They don't do that. It's amongst themselves. It's amongst territory sometimes. It's amongst, you know, somebody tried to rip somebody off. Somebody tried to beat you. Somebody took over somebody else's business. They don't go try to hurt innocent people.
Yeah, that's been my experience. I'm looking over my notes here from your book, and I note that I guess it was your first husband, Mark Ryder. You met him one night, and he was sitting with.
He wasn't my husband. He wasn't my husband.
Oh, you guys didn't get married. Okay, and when you met Mark Ryder the first night, he was sitting with John Gotti in a club in Manhattan. Can you tell us a little bit about that story? It describes him as being a dead ringer for actor Ray Liotta, a handsome, hard-faced dude.
He was very handsome, very, 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 very handsome. I was just out with my friends, and people like us could recognize other people. Like, I just knew they were street guys. We all could recognize each other, just our mannerisms. I was out with my sister and my girlfriends, and they sent me over a bottle of Dom Perignon. And I said, it was actually a bottle of Cristal, because John Gotti liked Cristal. And I sent it back. And then when I went on the dance floor, Mark Ryder came over and started dancing. And he was like, "You sent the bottle back." I was like, "Yeah, I don't want to be bothered." And he was like, "You know, it's John Gotti." I said, "I don't care who he is. Tell him I don't want nothing." But they like that feistiness. They like that, you know, you can handle your own. And then that's actually how I met Mark Ryder, was very persistent. I met John Gotti through him, but I already knew Bruce Cutler because Bruce Cutler was pretty well known, and we used him as an attorney. So I just knew all those guys, you know, through the neighborhood.
This Mark Ryder, best I could tell, he already was running a pretty decent size heroin distribution organization. And I have to assume if he can sit with John Gotti, then John Gotti was probably getting a piece of that action. I don't know if that ever came out, but can you tell us a little bit about
it? Well, they always get a piece of the action. I mean, if you're, you know, they always get, like, kickback from stuff like that. And then, in turn, the Gambino crime family protects those people if they have a problem in the street. So, I mean, they all got convicted on the heroin charges. Gene Gotti, I believe it was Anthony Coniglia, Mark Ryder, which were all connected to the Gambino crime family. So it's a public knowledge that heroin, actually even Angelo Ruggiero, that was caught on wiretap through DEA and FBI speaking about heroin and all of that. So that's all documented, that they were getting kickback from, Gambino crime family was getting kickback from the heroin trafficking.
Interesting. So much for the mafia ban on drug dealing, I guess. As long as you can distance yourself a little bit, why, if we had the same thing in Kansas City, guy would.
You know,
I do believe, though, that John Gotti, back in that time frame, the whole Gambino crime family, Polly Castellano, when he was killed and all of that, were the most biggest, notorious gangsters, as big as Al Capone. I mean, you know, you have tough guys, mobsters in Jersey, Chicago, wherever, but you've not heard of anyone like John Gotti. I mean, when you were to meet John Gotti, and if you ever met him, you would understand he walked in a room and there was so much charisma just reeking from him. Like, you would just know that he's somebody.
Yeah.
The way he presented himself. Here he is, a notorious cold-blooded killer, and he's on the cover of Time magazine. I don't know of anyone other than Al Capone that got the notoriety or the recognition other than John Gotti.
It's a good way to draw a lot of government attention, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of government attention. But is crime worth it? No, it's not worth it. It's not, you know, I have a totally different life, almost 30 years now. You know, that was when I was very young. I'm a totally different person today. I'm not the person I was. I live a very peaceful, great life. I raised my children differently. I try to teach people crime doesn't pay. I was very young, very naive. That's all I know. People can change. People can grow. And I believe when you have a harsh downfall like I did, I mean, with me, there were contracts out all my life. I was facing a lot of prison time, you know, so I had no other way to go but then to go up. I lost custody of one of my children. You know, the wiretaps of a hit on me were very real because the feds came to me and my attorney and made me listen to it. My whole life changed. I'm fearless. I'm not afraid. If I was afraid, I wouldn't have wrote a book. I feel that there's a bigger person than me watching over me. I'm very spiritual, very grounded. I speak out. I've always been that way. I feel that if I were to teach young women something, it's to teach them that whatever, you know, ethnic group or religion or gang or whatever you get involved in, and the guy is a bad boy, he's a drug dealer, he's a killer, it might look like a good life, or it might look, you know, fast lane, but it's not. It's going to bring you down to a level that you don't really want to go. I would never date a guy. I wouldn't be around those types of men today. I wouldn't condone anything they do today. Are there criminals still out there? Absolutely. Was it back like it was in the day? No. But it's not something that I would want to be proud of. It's actually something I'm ashamed of, and it's something that is very difficult for me to speak about. You got another question, and then I got to end it because I have another place I'm heading. So,
all right. I want to know a little bit about the man you did marry, John Fogerty.
Fogerty,
yeah.
John Fogerty.
And it looks like he was the father of some of you have some children by him. Matter of fact, I think
my two legs, yes.
Right.
Yes.
One of your daughters was even on the Mob Wives for the season or two that it was on, which is kind of interesting.
The Mob Wives of Pennsylvania?
No, the Mob Wives of New York. She was in Mob Wives of New York with some of, I think, Karen Gravano and I can't remember the other couple of gals on. That was a pretty exciting show.
Karen Gravano. Yeah, Renee Graziano. Yep, all of them. John Fogerty, a tough, very tough Irish guy from Staten Island, did what he had to do, drug runner himself, always, you know, in the streets, got involved with my brothers and other people I know in the street life. And then everyone got arrested and was facing a lot of time. I mean, he actually, him and my brother cooperated to take me off the case.
Oh, interesting. I've heard of that before, where a husband will go ahead and cooperate in order to keep his wife or child from being charged. That's a pretty common tool that law enforcement will use if it's possible to use it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them were facing a lot of years in prison. I mean, he did 10 years in prison. My brother did close to 15 years. A lot of the guys are still in that were on my case. People think that when you cooperate, you get a sweet deal. You still go to prison. You still come out and, you know, you have it hard or get relocated with a different name, different ID. But people think that you don't go to prison. Of course you go to prison. It might not be 25 years, but they did like 10, 15 years. You know, that's instead of doing 10 years and 25 to life, you know, it's just not a good life. It's everything about it is disgusting.
Yeah, what I've read about him, he was a pretty decent sized drug dealer moving. Had a Cuban connection out of through Colombia, I guess, and was bringing multiple kilos up into the East Coast. There was a huge amount of money. I bet you guys had a pretty high lifestyle. Probably looked like lifestyles of the rich and famous at one point in time.
Yeah, but it's all not worth it. Today I live a very humble, simple life. It's not, all of that's not worth it. Nothing impresses me today. What impresses me is people that live their life with integrity, that are honest, that are good, that are great husbands, great fathers, great members of the community, but the tough guy, the straight guy, I would not be around that today. It's just not good. But I believe when you're so entrenched in it and you don't see clearly, because I was so entrenched in that life, you don't know anything other than that life. You don't know. So I think for me, the best thing that happened to me was getting arrested, was losing everything, because when I was arrested and I was relocated, I was able to develop and I was able to grow and see that there's more to life than that. And being taken out of my environment was very, very, very scary for me, and being brought to an area where no one in that area is like me was so foreign and so scary that I had no other choice but to change and to grow up and to see that that lifestyle is wrong on every level.
So what is your life like today? I guess one last quick question. What is your life like? Are you working? Just doing like public appearances?
Yes, I'm retired. I have a wonderful life. I have a beautiful country home. I have four wonderful children that are all adults. I'm in the midst of planning a wedding for my daughter that's getting married in August. I had started several different businesses while I was here through the years that we sold a trucking company that did very well, and I retired from that, and I just have a good life. My day is I get up, I meditate, I am spiritually grounded, I pray, I go to the gym, I am socially connected in my community, I'm a member of the community. If I can help someone, I will. I have someone living with me now that I'm helping. So I give back, you know, to young women. I'm helping a young woman right now that was in a very bad abusive relationship. I'm helping her to get to where she needs to be. So I do give back. I always stay humble. I'm grateful for what I have. I just try to stay in a very peaceful, spiritual, humble, grateful mindset.
I would have to say for sure you folks want to be able to go to her website, which is Andrea Giovino. AndreaGiovino.net.
I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. My Instagram is just my name, Andrea Giovino, and I usually post on Instagram when my shows will appear, you know, when they're going to come out. Like, yeah. I believe the show for Gotti and Son is airing the Father's Day weekend. It's a two-part documentary, and it's very, very good. You have a lot of high-level law enforcement. You have Bruce Cutler's on. You have the judge that sentenced Gotti. You have the FBI agent that infiltrated Gotti. You have other law enforcement view on it. You have myself and John Gotti Jr. and Angel Gotti, which is John Gotti Sr.'s daughter. So it's all facts of what the lifestyle is about, what Gotti was really about, my view of Gotti on the outside, other than him being with his family, what he was like in the streets. So it's going to get a lot of recognition.
And that's on A&E?
It's on A&E. Yep. Okay. That's going to be coming out in June. But like I said, there'll be a lot of publicity on that when it airs. They'll promote it a lot. And I'll promote it on Instagram and Twitter.
Okay.
And your book is actually called Divorced from the Mob, My Journey from Organized Crime to Independent Woman. And that's available
by Andrea G. Right, exactly.
And that's available on Amazon.com.
Yep.
Right now. And that's correct. That's a tell-all book. I mean, there's some information correct. On your website. Gary's got a couple pages of notes. We didn't get a chance to go into some of this stuff. But, folks, if you're listening and you're really interested and you want to learn more, what you want to do is get Andrea's book.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it. Okay, Andrea, we will we'll let you go off, and Aaron and I will talk a little more about some of these people you're involved with. I did a lot of research on them. They have quite a checkered history, especially this Frank Leno, the first guy that kind of brought you into the lifestyle as a young adult. He was a Mr. New York Mafia for a while, it looks to me like.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was pretty well respected in the streets back then. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks. Yep. Thanks a lot, Andre.
Very much so.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Well, here you have in your notes, two of her brothers carried out contract murders for rival crime families.
Yeah. John Bubblegum Silvestri was a freelance button man for Lucchese's, and her other brother, Frankie Silvestri, was a member of the Colombo crime family. So she, you know, as she said, her mom ran a gambling operation for Crazy Joe Gallo. So this is a complete mob family. She wasn't just whistling Dixie, as we say down south here, that when she talked about growing up in the mafia.
Well, here in your notes, you say when she was 20, and she's a very beautiful woman, so I can imagine at 21 years old, she was quite attractive. But here in your notes, you're saying that Frank Leno, who was a captain in the Bonanno crime family, whose boss was Sonny Red, pronounce that name?
Indelicato.
Indelicato.
Sonny Red Indelicato, I think.
Who was in the movie, portrayed in the movie Donnie Brasco. But Frank Leno bought her a 1978 Mercedes-Benz 450 SL convertible as a Valentine's Day gift.
Really? He also bought matching platinum presidential Rolex watches. And the best I could find out about Frank Leno is he didn't really wear jewelry that much. He was not a flashy kind of guy. He was a real old-school, low-key mob kind of guy. So interesting stuff. Huh?
Yeah, other than that 450 SL.
Yeah, well,
that's quite a Valentine's Day gift right there.
That's what you buy for your Gemara, the one you really care about.
Yeah, it's hard to say no to that.
Yes, it would be.
But unfortunately, then here he was, Frank Leno, on May 18th in 1962, was arrested for the shooting of two Brooklyn police detectives.
I know, I saw that. They're robbing a tobacco store, it says. There's probably more than that. I mean, $5,000 in 1962 in a tobacco store. There's more to that story, I'm sure. No doubt about it. But best I could find out, that he was charged. And it's kind of interesting what happened to him when he went to the police station. Now, I know a situation in Kansas City where a guy shot and killed a cop. And when he went to the police station, they needed some information out of him, and they were not pleasant with him, that's for sure. But in this case, he was left with a broken arm and a broken leg when he left out, and they did some other horrible stuff to him.
Well, they got the information. They must have got some information then.
Yeah.
Because they might not have stopped at a broken arm or a broken leg.
No. According to this, what I read, they did the old New York police trick, and I've never heard of this before, except that other case where it really happened, is they took a broomstick and stuck it up his butt. That'll make you talk. If nothing else will, that will. Then, you know, that dude got caught doing that, so I don't know whether that story's true or not. But
well, it would be hard to be pressed out to talk when you know when they released you that the Bonanno crime family was going to come looking and find out what you had to say to the cops.
Yeah,
they always seem to know when you get pinched.
Yes.
All these different mob guys always seem to know that, I think that guy got pinched. They got a lot of folks on the street watching. And so I'd take that broom handle probably in lieu of, you know.
Yeah. And you know, his boss, the Sonny Red Indelicato, he was a Bonanno capo with this guy named Dominic Napolitano and Dominic Trinchera. And if you ever seen the image of the guy called the cigar, Carmine Galante, where he's been killed and he always smoked a cigar. They called him the cigar. And when he's dead, one of the New York Post, I think, photographers got a picture of him laying there in a puddle of blood underneath his table, which was in an outside patio, with a cigar still clenched between his teeth. It's a pretty famous, iconic mafia hit picture. So his boss was part of that three-person team, these capos, Napolitano and Trinchera and Sonny Red and Delicato are the ones that killed him.
These were all Bonanno capos?
Right, and they wanted to move him aside, and it had been approved, but then somebody decided that those guys needed to go, and somebody set them up to kill them, and Frank Leno was there when that happened. And he ran out the door as they started shooting down the hitters on the cigar of Carmine Galante's hit. So he kind of led a charmed life. He was able to go on and continue in his mob career until he eventually caught some kind of a case and went into the witness protection program and testified and all that. So these were some real deal guys she was involved with. That Mark Reeder, I looked back up on him. That was her kind of the guy that was convicted with all the Gottis on a heroin conspiracy in New York. You know what he was convicted for besides running heroin? Murder. And he must have been.
I was going to say tax evasion.
Tax evasion. Yeah, no, there's no Al Capone mob here. This is convicted him of murder. He killed three people, and I'm not sure. I got a feeling he must have been supplying a black organization. Back in the 60s and 70s, just before the crack cocaine hit, heroin was a drug of choice in the black community in Kansas City and all over the community. It was the most popular drug, I think, partly because of packaging and effect. And he found out that Nicky Barnes was testifying. Well, Nicky Barnes was, you know, kind of the black godfather of New York City and had a huge heroin operation. And when Nicky Barnes came in and started testifying, then he killed three people. And one of them, her name was called Shemeca, Beverly Shemeca Ash. And so I would bury Bones Wilson. Now, Bones might not be a particularly a black nickname, but Shemeca is. So I would say this was a black organization they were supplying. And he took a hit for that and went away for a long time. I didn't really see much more about him.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot. That Reeder did that.
Yeah, Mark Reeder. There wasn't much more about him. But, you know, this next guy, John Fogerty, which he's kind of hard to Google and research because you're finding all this stuff about
John Fogerty.
John Fogerty.
I'm like, I love his music.
Yeah.
And you were married to him? I never realized that he was, running drugs.
He had a double life. He was kind of like Dean Torrance who took a stood trial, maybe he got not guilty, or he took a minor conviction in the kidnapping of Frank Sinatra Jr., a little known fact about Dean Torrance. But this is not that John Fogerty, Aaron. You realize that, don't you?
We
don't want John Fogerty to sue us.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the song that he might have written about all his cocaine trafficking.
Cocaine. I can't think of any of their songs now off the top of my head. Google them quick.
Unless they can run through the jungle, but...
There you go. Well,
it turns out he was talking about New York City.
Yeah, it's a jungle. It's a jungle in New York City, especially in the cocaine business. So this is more up in the 70s, and that's when cocaine is huge. When cocaine hit, I don't know, those of you of a certain age and from a certain subculture, or if you're involved with narcotics investigation, or if you're involved with partying in the 70s, boy, cocaine, when it hit, it was just everywhere. And it started out kind of the higher-end clubs because it seemed expensive, and it soon permeated all the nightclubs and the entire drinking, young person's drinking culture of every major city. And this John Fogerty was supplying everybody in New York City, it appears to me.
Well, but he couldn't have done that without the approval of some of the families.
Oh yeah. He had to be kicking up, as we say, to
the Gotti.
Probably to Gotti. He had to be kicking up.
Wetting his beak.
Yes, exactly. Andrea may have been kind of, her connections may have helped him move in that mob world and get that those kinds of connections. And he was already developing the cocaine kick connections out of a guy from Cuba, had a Cuban connection down in Florida, which would have gotten the cocaine. And during the early days, it all came up out of Columbia directly to Florida and then on up the East Coast and up through Atlanta and into the Midwest before the government clamped down so much. And then they started coming across the Mexican border and the Pacific Ocean and through L.A. So it, you know, it's like whack-a-mole when you talk about shutting down cocaine
distribution.
Cocaine distribution, you whack it down one place and it pops up another, just like this building this wall to keep immigrants and drugs out from Mexico. Well, you know,
they're tunneling right under it already.
They're already tunneling. They've already tunneled under the border. You know, huge tunnels. You know, tunnels that start a mile back and end a mile on the other side and come up into a warehouse and stuff like that. So it's whack-a-mole. But anyhow, John Fogerty had this connection, and best I could learn, he actually bought a $100,000 speedboat and named it Andy Girl, which is, she said they called her Andy when she was real young. She would say that John would rent a limo and drive it to Atlantic City with a trunk full of cocaine to deliver to his distributors down at Atlantic City and down in New Jersey. So it was he was a character. He was a tough dude.
Well, he was a bad dude.
Yeah.
I'm reading your notes where he said he had some Brazilian connections.
Oh, God.
To get cocaine.
Tell that story. Yeah.
Fogerty showed what he was made of when he set up two guys from Brazil who were transporting a large load of cocaine to him at a meeting in Hell's Kitchen. Fogerty took the drugs, kept the money, and shot the Brazilians and left them for dead. Fogerty's mob partners now knew that they could count on him.
He'd do the deal. He would do the deal. You know, we had that same thing happen to a guy named Vest, V-E-S-T, killed a couple of Mexican dudes that brought 4 or 5 kilos up from Mexico. And he was an established drug dealer. Kind of interesting thing about him, a connection back to the mafia, is this Vest had a job, like his kind of job that he'd show up at every day, even while he was running this cocaine distribution network here in Kansas City. You know, using multiple kilos of cocaine, he had a job working at Roma Bread Company, which was owned by Joe Filardo. And Joe Filardo was one of the 1930s, 40s, 50s mob bosses in Kansas City. Matter of fact, Joe Filardo, who owned Roma Bakery, is the one who took Nick Savella to the Appalachian Convention in 1957 and introduced him as the boss of Kansas City. So we never could connect him to with money wise. He wouldn't talk, but he shot and killed a couple of these Mexican dudes and hid their bodies. He buried their bodies. They just disappeared off the face of the earth. Finally, some member of his organization came in and talked about it, and they ended up making a case on him on that, I believe. But he never would talk about the mob connections that he had.
Put him in the back of a Roma bakery truck and took him out in the country.
Really ran him.
Roma's still around.
Ran him through the bread machine. We shouldn't talk bad about Roma bread.
No,
we'll get sued again.
Roma's good bread.
Yeah, it is. It is good bread.
It's a fine Italian bread, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. It's
because the bakery is still used by Chubby's on Broadway, which it was when the Labruzzos owned it as well. They got their meats from B&C, and they got their bread from Roma.
Yeah, I remember one time we were on a wire, speaking of people dealing with people, and we're on a wire, had a bug or something in the Savellas. One of the younger Savella kids was running it, and Carl Savella, Corky, next brother, would come in a lot, and they were talking about how business was down, and Corky was overheard to say, well, let's just get on the phone, call all of these Goombas out here and tell them they need to make sure they order all their it was a condiment company, all their bar condiments, order all our condiments from us, and, you know, call Pat O'Brien. And, you know, we knew who Pat O'Brien was. He was, he had an Irish name, but he was half Italian. He was a gambler. So, you know, that's kind of how it works. If you're connected to them in any way, you're going to do business with them within the family, shall we say. And it's such a closed network, as Andrea talked about. It's such a close society, a close community, and people really feel comfortable dealing with each other, and they do not like to go to outsiders. I guess we're all kind of tribal in some manner like that.
Well, they know those people, I would think.
Yeah.
You know, they know how they behave. You know, like she would say that she would be out at a club, and she could tell who the street guys were because of their mannerisms.
Yeah, yeah.
They know each other. They're clear polished nails.
Yeah, really. They're obviously they went to the manicurist. I was following a mob guy once, and he went in and he got a manicure. Well, I happen to know the manicurist, but I didn't know that she knew him so well. I called her later and I said, "Hey, can't remember her name now, so long ago. That man that you gave a manicure this afternoon about 2 o'clock, Snag Klein, do you know him?" She said, "Why, Mr. Klein, yes, I know him very well. I've done his nails for years." So I start asking around, and I find out later that this has been his girlfriend. You know, all the mob guys have a girlfriend. He was a Jewish mob guy, but he was a mob guy. All the mob guys have a girlfriend. She'd been his girlfriend for years.
Doing his nails.
Yeah, really. Kind of, one last story about Fogarty is how he got popped, and how she talked about how he made a deal in order to keep her out of it, and her brother made a deal to keep her out of it. He had gotten to doing, he was doing drugs so bad that she actually, what I read, she got him to go to treatment. He went to treatment in rehab in Kentucky. Of course, he's out of his element. He's down there in the Bluegrass Mafia, the Dixie Mafia territory down there. He doesn't know all the players. And so he meets a guy in the treatment center, and the guy claims that he can get a great deal on this Kentucky marijuana, which was pretty well known at the time, as they raised some really high-grade marijuana. You know, they quit down in the hills down there in the Ozarks the same way. They quit making moonshine whiskey because there wasn't any money in it anymore, so they started making
Kentucky bluegrass
really high-grade marijuana way back up in the hills. Actually, Steve Earle did a whole song about it called Copperhead Road. But
is that one of your crime songs?
Yeah. I put Copperhead Road in up there. He made a deal with this dude, and he was going to pick up $100,000 worth of high-grade marijuana. When he met the people with them, he had the money, and when he met the people who was supposed to have the marijuana, he met the DEA. And this treatment center friend turned out to be, there's certain people out there, men out there primarily, maybe a few women, primarily men, who just work as professional informants, and they're able to operate around the country in these different drug subcultures, and know the lingo and know some of the people, and for money, for big money, they will set up these big deals. And this guy was one of those professional paid confidential informers. So he was popped and charged with interstate trafficking. And then the FBI started taking a look at him a little closer. They ended up running some wires on him. They heard some conversations about collecting debts and making threats. That's where Andre got into it, it looked to me like. So in the end, they served some more search warrants ended up, it says, what best I could tell, Fogarty confessed to several murders, and he served 6 years in the penitentiary, in one of those witness protection penitentiaries, and then came out and has been in witness protection ever since. I didn't get a chance to ask him about Hogarty, if he was still around or what the deal was.
If they were still in contact?
Yeah, I think maybe they are, but I don't know. I guess it's not really important. I don't like to mess around with somebody in their safety, I guess.
Yeah.
Her brother confessed to the murder of 9 men and is living in the witness protection program for sure. What I read is she was given $75,000 and kind of steered to a new life in a new town. She would not go into witness protection program and relocate under their auspices. So she just moved down here. It looks like down to Pennsylvania. Says that some of the DEA agents got friendly with her, and they're the ones that helped her move. And as she said, her life today is much different than what it was, other than going back, doing shows like this and doing that special on John Gotti and Bruce Cutler, his lawyer, and all the other people in the Gotti family and some of Gotti's relatives, to really get some insight. That'll be an interesting A&E documentary.
That comes out in June. Gotti and Son.
Right.
On
Father's Day.
On Father's Day weekend.
In May, I think. And there's that June.
She was saying it was in June. We'd have to look that up here. It is Sunday, June 17th.
Oh, it's way in June.
Yeah. Well, so there was a part in this that it was interesting that you wrote that we didn't get to talk to Andrea about, which was when she was served a search warrant on 4 Staten Island residences. So they must have been making a little bit of money to yeah. own 4 homes on Staten Island.
Yeah, I think they were doing okay. Now, sometimes that can be deceptive, but my personal first-person experience with drug dealers, they will own, one of them might have been their home, and the other were 3 rental properties that they used as stash houses, and maybe some of their other dealers might live in them and use them as stash houses. That's
common.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty common. They'll have more than one home, but it'll be other people live in them, and they're I'm not sure if that meant that they owned 4 homes that they moved around in, but it would be my bet that they were stash houses that they kept. Find those stash houses. We've hit those stash houses, and you find the scales. You'll find packaging and packaging and packaging, but if you don't hit them at exactly the right time when they've just got in the load, and hadn't had a chance to distribute it, why, you won't find it there. So it's, we hit one once. The guys were living in it, and we saw them. They'd been out of town. They came back, and all of a sudden, there's all kind of activity around the house. We're frantically trying to type up a search warrant. Our probable cause was thin at best.
What are you going to say? A lot of activity around the home.
Well, we had a bunch of other, they were L.A. gang people with drug connections in Los Angeles, and one of them had left town and went to L.A., and he had just got back, and as soon as he gets back, why, there's all kinds of people coming and going from the house. And so we have a crew sitting in the back in a garage taking pictures, and we take a picture of 2 guys walking out with a big sack. Those trash sacks are real thin, and we get the search warrant about an hour and a half later, and there's nothing in there. We find a hidey hole up in the underneath the eaves of the attic that's obviously a hidey hole. We can't find anything in there, but when we blow up that picture, we look at it, and you can see the kilos of cocaine inside that trash sack, because this sack was like stretched so thin over the and the light hit it just right that you could see inside a little bit inside the sack. So
and they had just like kilo bricks or something of cocaine.
Yeah, and we just missed that. Well, that's how we got onto it. We got the trash out of that family or that house 2 or 3 weeks before that. And when we pulled out, we emptied out the trash bags. There was about 5 these foil wrappers with tape and Spanish writing on them that were obvious. We test them, and they'd been bricks of cocaine that they brought into the house and then repackaged and distributed out. So
they just like threw away the wrapping.
Yeah. Win some, you lose some.
So when they're in the garage and they're taking photographs, and the guys come out with a sack or garbage bag, they don't want to blow their cover of going, wait, there's the cocaine right there. Let's just get out of the garage and bust them.
Yeah, the problem is when you're taking pictures like that, you can't, there's not time, you don't really focus on, you're just taking pictures, just popping pictures. Yeah, you see he's got a trash sack. Of course, they're telling us he got a trash sack. We get somebody on him, we try to follow him, and they lost him. They got over in Kansas, and they lost him. And then we found out later they had another apartment over in Kansas rented that then they'd start distributing out of there to another place. So it's whack-a-mole. It's just they know to keep moving and keep moving. It's a difficult business, this investigating drug gangs. All right. So I think that's we probably wrapped her up.
Well, we've got to tell folks, remember to go over to her website, Andrea Giovino. AndreaGiovino.net. That's the website. And check out her book, which is available on Amazon.
Divorced from the Mob.
And you may want to set your DVR for Sunday, June 17th for the TV show on A&E called Gotti and Son. And she's one of the people they're interviewing.
Cool. Well, if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, or you know somebody that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, somebody you care about, have them call First Call. 816-361-5900, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to purchase for only $7. And when you get done watching that, and you're going to want to know more, you're going to want to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then if that's not enough and doesn't pique your interest, you're going to want to get Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And you're going to read that, and it's the words of the mouth from the men that did it. And then you're going to want to get the Kindle version where you can actually hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it. The Kindle version has video clips with transcriptions because sometimes you can't understand quite what they're saying. But with the help of Gary Jenkins' video transcriptions, you can hear the men talking that did the crimes.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music. I mean, that's fine if we can, if that's what works for her and you can still do that.
Sorry. I don't know how we got mixed up. I thought it was tomorrow, but that's okay. I can answer your question.
Okay. Are you sure? Are you okay with this?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. That's fine. All right. Go ahead.
Great. I was just racking my brain trying to think back to the office. Do I have anything written down for tomorrow? But I can't think of anything. But if you're good, let's go ahead and get this done. And, I'm sitting here in the studio with my friend Aaron, and as you know, we do this podcast, and I just kind of want to, ask you some. You've done these kind of interviews before, and just tell a little bit about your life, and tell some stories from the mob, and we'll work your book in there. And you have any other Twitter accounts, or do you do any social media marketing with that, or?
I just do Instagram.
Okay, yeah.
Did you go on my website?
I think I did. God,
what,
that was.
What is it?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I just usually do a lot of when I'm asked to do. Like I said, there's a new show coming out in June on Father's Day weekend called Gotti and Son, so that's going to have a lot of publicity on it.
Okay.
And usually I just do like most, the upscale stuff that's accurate. And,
okay.
Yeah. True about the lifestyle.
Yeah, I understand. And that,
the lifestyle.
That's what we want. We like to keep our credibility. We just like to do accurate information from somebody who either lived the lifestyle or investigated it and was really close to it, like agents and police officers. So that's really what we focus on.
First person accounts.
Yeah, first person accounts. Aaron said.
What is the
sure?
What is, your, is your website? Is it www.divorcefromthemob.com? If I remember right, or is it?
No, it's just my name, Andrea Giovino,
okay.
At Comcast. It's Andrea Giovino at Comcast.net. I mean, you could actually she can go on it while we're speaking, and then she can maybe get some questions from the website if she'd like to see anything from there that you want to ask. Or
yeah, did you get that, Aaron?
It's andreagiovino.net.
yeah, and andreagiovino.net.
I'm just trying to pull it up right now,
and the website will show all of the media, TV,
okay.
All the stuff I've done.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I did look at that, but I mainly went in and wrote myself kind of a little thumbnail sketch of stuff I could find out about that you'd been involved in, like Frank Leno and then what's his name? Mark. I have to go back here.
Mark Ryder.
Mark Ryder and then Mr. Fogarty. As I was reading this about you and Mark Ryder, the only thing that kept running through my mind was this song by the Eagles, Life in the Fast Lane. Do you remember any of the lyrics?
Oh,
from
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was brutally handsome. Yep, she was turtlingly pretty.
Yeah. I just think the lifestyle is very, very tough lifestyle. It's, you know, people don't understand, like, when you're from that lifestyle, it's kind of survival mode. So it's more or less, you know, when they're raised into that, it's a whole different breed of what the normal people understand of what life is about, because you're taught at a very young age to kind of survive as a fighter.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's fight or flight, and I'm a fighter by nature. So, you know, I always come up with, in that sense, trying to do the best I can for me and my family.
Yeah, I understand. It's kind of like, and when you're brought up in that lifestyle, it's like the normal kind of checks and balances in life. Like, you know, you don't particularly call the police unless there's some huge emergency. You handle it yourself within the lifestyle, the normal kind of social restrictions and social things that.
Well,
that
I mean, back in the day in the '80s, it was like that. But today, I think they, you know, it's not like that so much. Today, it's more when people get caught with. It's so hard to be a criminal today because, truthfully, with all the technology,
really?
You know, how they can infiltrate, it's very, very hard.
Yeah.
So, I think that with that, back in the day, yeah, they didn't call the cops, but today, with people cooperating, they more or less do that.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So,
Plus, it's a whole different life. The technology is a killer today to try to commit a crime. From a littlest crime to the biggest crime,
right.
Technology is just a killer. I was just sitting with some guys.
So, being that I thought it was tomorrow, and I'm so sorry, but I have about a half hour. So, if you come up with the questions, I'll answer them
okay.
for you. And then,
all right, let me,
an idea.
Andrea, do you still go by Andy or Andrea? Should I call Andy or
Andrea?
Andrea.
Yeah, just back to growing up, my family calls me Andy.
Okay, all right,
that's just how we grew up. But
okay, we're gonna get started here. I want to do a little thing. I'm gonna welcome people and say hello to my co-host, and then we will. Then I'll say hello to you, and then we'll kind of officially start.
All right, let me just get my stuff in my vehicle.
I'm just bringing it up so I can play.
What did she, excuse me?
Go ahead, Andrea. Just we're going to do a little thing. And when you come back on, see, I edit this, so don't worry, but it's not live. And so just go ahead and do what you got to do. And then when you come back, just.
Okay, yeah, I'm in snow right now. It's snowing here in PA. So I'm just running errands and doing some stuff. So as long as you could hear me clearly, that's fine.
We can hear you great.
Yeah, just bring
So that's fine. Okay. Whenever you're ready, then.
Okay. We're going to bring your mic down for just a few minutes.
Okay.
Phone's down.
Former Kansas City Police Department.